Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Fringe Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how's it hanging?
Well, I must say that, you know, I have very, very little to complain about if the weather is my main concern at this very moment, so.
Good times, good times. And of course, we also have our favorite son of the East Rand. I don't know, it's maybe second favorite because Becky's also from East Rand, I guess. But sharing the title with best son of the East Rand, Mr. Marius Root. Marius, how are you?
How's it, guys?
All right, so let us get into the news of today. And of course, we're going to start off with the passion, the great love of Marius's life. And that is, of course, cricket, South African cricket. And it's been a bit of a dark time for the sport recently. It keeps having scandals. It keeps having internal squabbles. There's been all sorts of hand-wringing and squabbling about various issues. And the most recent, of course, is that the Proteas coach, Mark Boucher, is going to be going before a disciplinary action committee, which has been instituted against him by Cricket South Africa. As part of its social justice and nation-building hearings. And here he is going to answer for several charges, including that he used racial language against a former Proteas teammate, Paul Adams. He's also accused of treating his former assistant coach, Enoch Nkwe, in a manner unbecoming of a leader in his position, and also for allegedly bumbling the Black Lives Matter issue within the Proteas squad and how it was reacted. How the team would react to it, and there was a lot of internal division caused by that. His legal team seems to be very well funded. It looks like a lot of people with lots of money in South Africa are willing to put their money behind Mark Boucher in his defense. And so now, yeah, we've got a bit of a showdown for him, although I'm sure his spirits were lifted a bit by the fact that we crushed India recently. But still, Marius, anything I left out, anything I got wrong? What's your take on the whole Mark Boucher trial thing?
No, I think you got it pretty much spot on there, Nick. I think a lot of what Mark Boucher has been charged with there is probably fair. I mean, so one of the main things is in the late 90s, early 2000s, there was a team song which apparently Mark Boucher was on the instigators where they sang about Paul Adams, who's obviously a left-arm spinner from those days. And this is relevant to the story. Paul Adams is colored, and the song used to refer to Paul Adams as a brown shit. So that's obviously not great, and it's not something you should be doing. And Mark Boucher apparently did acknowledge that he'd, it was not really acceptable, and it could definitely be offensive, and things have changed now. And look, this thing also did happen 2 decades ago. I mean, there's very few people, I think, who can say that they didn't do anything that they fit a little bit ashamed of in their early 20s. And they're looking back on it, from Mark Boucher's age, which is 45 now. But, I mean, that wasn't great. I mean, maybe Mark Boucher does need to get taken to task for it. But, I mean, it did happen 2 decades ago. You know, it's also easy for somebody like me to say, you know, Paul Adams just move on. But, you know,
It does feel like this should have been dealt with a long time ago. I don't know, you know, the fact that it's coming out now and being dealt with only now seems like it's going to be the sort of thing that makes it much worse. You know, it's like whenever there's an allegation against someone and it's an old allegation, it always makes the passage of justice less clean and efficient.
Well, justice delayed is justice denied. I mean, it's one of those, you know, little quaint sayings, but right. I think sometimes it's true. But then, if Mark Boucher did treat Enoch Nkwe poorly, then that's something I think that needs to be looked at. But it's hard to prove that maybe that he was treated poorly because of his race. I mean, but then I think one of the things that is really worrying for me, as I say, I think some of the stuff that Mark Boucher has been accused of, yeah, I think it's worth looking at. Maybe Mark Boucher does need to get taken to task for it. But he's been charged with acting in a subliminally racist way. And how do you act in a subliminally racist way? How do you prove it? I mean, it's kind of... you know, Orwellian thought police. You acted subliminally racist. How? I mean, if it was subliminal, obviously I didn't mean to do it. You can't really blame somebody then.
And this is what makes me really disturbed about all of this. It's like, you know, maybe he is guilty of some things that he perhaps should be disciplined for, and maybe even thrown out of being coach. But when you have a charge like that against you, it really doesn't, let's just say, it doesn't give one a lot of confidence that you're going to go through a fair trial, which is going to do a passive and objective analysis of the evidence. Herman, exactly. What do you make of this?
Yeah, no, of this whole spiel, I'm particularly concerned by two things. It's sort of like Cricket South Africa realized, oh, we're winning again. Well, can't let that happen. So, you know,
Cricket South Africa can't keep good news in the news for too long. It has to go back to that every time.
Yeah. So that's the irritation, just as a South African, to think like, really, is this the way to go about it? We've just turned a corner. We've just, you know, done something useful in terms of progressing the sport to a level that we all expect.
Beaten the best test side in the world.
Beaten the best test side, you know, wipe them clean in the ODIs. Can't they just sort this thing out? So that's the one frustration, just as a common citizen idea. The other thing really is that the whole idea of social justice and critical race theory, it really threatens to turn us into, or to turn people into the boy who cried racism. Is that there's actual racism out there. There are actual instances of racial discrimination. And to fixate on things like acting in a subliminally racist way, it just makes a mockery of the idea that racial justice is something achievable, because justice is an objective pursuit. It is the redressing of wrongs from an objective measurement. And that's why we have legal standards like the reasonable man, the reasonable person, and reasonable expectations of privacy. You know, the law is absolutely infused with this idea that some form of justice must be made manifest in a way that everyone can identify it. And when you head into the territory of, you know, Orwellian thought police acting in a subliminally racist way, you're just undermining any real effort to actually get rid of racism in, you know, institutional racism, if there is such a thing. Because yes, there is something like institutional racism. We've seen it historically. But you know what was the hallmark of institutional racism? Is institutions that had racial policies, that acted against people in a specific way. The Nazis weren't subliminally anti-Semitic. They were overtly anti-Semitic. And that is why we hate them, not because they sort of had bad thoughts about Jews, but because they killed millions of Jewish people. So if we're going to take racism seriously, we have to get away from this nonsense of, you know, microaggressions and subliminal. It makes a mockery of the whole process.
Yeah, it's interesting how Cricket South Africa seems to me to be kind of a bit of a case study for how the way that race has been talked about in South Africa over the last 25 years or so has really become just so sort of dysfunctional. We've got, of course, the ongoing drama about racial quotas, which we, as being a non-racial institution, think are a terrible idea, and that they just end up causing more division than this, which is the exact opposite of what they're supposed to do. There's also the fact that racism also seems to be used sometimes as a cover for, by some people, as an accusation of racism seems to be used as a cover, but occasionally to take down an enemy or to get revenge on someone or to put yourself back in the news. And it's just such a mess. Any final words on this, Maurice, before we move on?
Just an insight at one of the cricket unions, and this just shows you how anything can be perceived. Apparently, Paul Adams, he used to be coach of the Western Firms, or the Cobras, whatever you want to call it. And a lot of the guys, a lot of the Muslim players who played under Paul Adams felt excluded, because Paul Adams apparently likes to drink. He liked to spend some time with the players who did drink after the game, you know, have a couple of drinks and, you know, socialize. And the Muslim players felt like if you didn't have a drink with the coach after the game, your odds of playing in the next game or being, you know, getting opportunities is a bit reduced. And there's another there. Then if this is true, as I say, this is hearsay from somebody I know that's involved in one of the cricket unions. I won't say which one. I mean, there's an example. I think that's a very good example. If this is true, of people being excluded on their culture, and it's not great. People, I mean, we've just saw now how Usman Khawaja, Pat Cummins, who's the captain of the Australian cricket team, got kudos for when they beat England in the Ashes. He told the guys not to spray any champagne because Usman Khawaja is a Muslim. Obviously not, so they waited before they started celebrating the champagne for Khawaja first to be in the team photos with the trophy and all that kind of thing. And I think, so, and especially in a country like South Africa, we have all kinds, we have different races, different religions, different cultures. And to get a successful team, I think you have to get all those kind of things working together. And Sean, we've seen issues in the process of the race, but we've seen Paul Adams himself is not immune. He's, you know, seems to have been, you know, as I said, it's all yesterday, so I don't take it as gospel, but he might have been insensitive to Muslim players in the team. So, and, you know, this, if Paul Adams goes accused of Mark Bouch of all kinds of things, you know, might be opening up a can of worms, maybe doesn't want to really be opened. And also, apparently, he used to call Mark Bouch a bit my. So that's also something in it.
Oh, <boy. But> anyway. Yeah, no, this is, I have a feeling this is not going to end well for anyone. But we'll see. I mean, Mark Boucher has a lot of legal people, a lot of legal heavyweights behind him, as far as I understand. So I'm sure that if there's a chance that he can win this one, it's definitely he's got the best shot he's going to have.
Nick, okay. If I may say a last thing on this whole debacle, is that it's as though, you know, in the last 3 years, the world has absolutely lost the idea of something not being clear cut, you know, with COVID, with Trump, and even with racism, possibly there's this risk of choosing between extremes. When you don't have to choose between, you know, being a race fanaticist that sees racism everywhere and being, you know, the sort of parody of the right wing conservative that just, you know, ignores everything about racism. No, you know, just man up if you're in the team. You know, there is an actual issue here where things like symbolism and spaces of collaboration and feeling welcome, these things are real. I mean, human beings are emotional creatures. You can't just dismiss complaints about feeling, you know, a certain way in certain circles and communities. And what frustrates me about this is that if the one side starts pushing from the left in terms of the, you know, everything is racist, every, you know, microaggression, social justice, subliminal racism, institutional racism, unconscious biases, that the other side then that people who should actually be in the moderate middle risk being pushed to the other extreme of you know, dismissing the problem entirely as absolutely a non-thing. And I would just urge listeners not to go down either of those routes, to say that, you know, there is this middle ground, this healthy middle ground where one can say, let's make people feel included based on who they are racially, ethnically, culturally, linguistically. And that makes us better people. And if you think that's fuzzy, you're welcome to think that. But I just think that if we're going to try and go for decency, then, you know, taking these things seriously, but with reason, is a way to go.
Can I just add also one last thing? There's actually an article today, I've managed to read the whole thing, but saying South African cricket coaches are quite sought after, especially in Asia, because they're very good at handling different cultures, different religions in one team and getting guys to play for a certain, you know, a single goal. And I think that tells you something about, you know, I think how South Africa's moved on in the past 30 years and how people, and was Lars Kloos and Mickey Arthur were singled out. I mean, those are obviously two white guys, and they are apparently very good at handling different cultures and beliefs and so on within the team environment. And so, I mean, I think we can do it, but it's just, yeah, I mean, I think there's lots of noise outside the teams and outside this kind of thing that also gets involved in this stuff.
Right. Herman, we're going to move on now because we are spending too much time on this one. All right, let us go on to something I think, a little bit more productive, which is rather than talking about cricket, to say shooting itself in the head, which it is wont to do. And that is the subject of election
reform. Nick, talking about cricket is always productive. We could talk about it all show and it would still be productive.
Yeah,
we could talk about all show all week. Yeah.
Sorry, what's that on that banner behind you? What's the first R for? And what's the second R for? The race relations. Okay, no.
So, of course, if Morris had his way, this would be the Daily Cricket Show, but fortunately it's not. So we want to be talking about something which I think we've been thinking about for a while now, and which ideas have been kind of kicking around South Africa's intellectual sphere for decades now, and that's on the subject of electoral reform. So Herman, this is something that has animated you very much. And I know Marius has actually done some work on this as well to look at what can be done. So I have two sort of starting questions. The first one is, what's wrong with the current electoral system? And the second question is, how much of the problem really is just due to the system, and how much of it is due to the sort of political culture that we have, which may not necessarily be the same thing at all?
The first question is actually, I think, a relatively easy one to answer. Currently in South African politics, if you want to be a member of parliament, if you want to represent, the people of South Africa democratically, the way to do that is to be chosen high enough on a party list, whether that's provincial or national, by the leaders of a party with a fair chance of being elected to parliament. So if you want to actually serve in parliament, you've got very little incentive to serve constituents and a great incentive to serve party bosses, because they are the ones ultimately that determine whether you are elected or not. And that's the problem with the proportional system. Breaking it down to a very, very rudimentary form is you have a list, the bigger parties submit lists of 400 names. There are 400 seats in the National Assembly. If you win 60% of the votes, you get the first 60% of your 400 seats, a list goes to parliament. Now, that's a gross oversimplification. You go down to provincial level and contributions is a bit different, but that's essentially the thrust of it. And why I think that's a problem is there's absolutely no accountability to parliament actually having a direct pressure to respond to the concerns of citizens and voters. Voters have almost no direct line of communication that they can enforce with a constitutional, momentum or pressure behind it to say that you represent my interests in parliament and I need you to pursue this issue or pursue that issue or oppose this or that. So I think that's the first problem. It is creates this distance between what the parties want to do in terms of their own interests and serving those party interests, guaranteeing you a good chance of being an MP rather than serving the people. And the question, what was the second question again?
How much of this is really down to systemic problems? Often people will say, oh, we need to change the system, and then they change the system and it doesn't actually fix the problems, because the problems are to do with things like political culture and voting behavior and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. So the thing is, electoral reform is no silver bullet, but it is a bullet. In a country where politics is, embarrassingly unaccountable, any little taste of accountability that can be injected into the system, I think, is welcome. South Africans have not covered themselves in glory in this current system. I think, for example, the ability of citizens to exert pressure on government is something that is massively underutilized. I don't think citizens take seriously the obligation and right they have to contact elected representatives and actually put some pressure on ministers, on portfolio committees, on members of parliament. So South Africans have to, do some introspection when it comes to why the system of unaccountable politics is allowed to thrive in South Africa. But electoral reform, where there is some direct line of accountability, where you can look at a member of parliament and say, that person represents my area of the country, I need to go to them with my problems, they need to air it on a national level, that's an injection of, I think, some tangible accountability that hopefully, as a knock-on effect, can encourage people to use the other forms or the other channels of accountability that even exist now.
So, Marius, there's a comment here from Danny Archer, which is talking about the problem with constituency-based systems, which is that they inevitably have to use first-past-the-post. And we've seen that a lot of countries, they have first-past-the-post systems. The UK is one of the best-known examples of this. A party that gets sort of 37% of the vote can get 50% of the seats and therefore is the sort of dominant power. So why would we want to abandon a PR system for a constituency-based system? Herman's just talked about accountability to some degree, but in the proposals that you did, what measures did you talk about?
Yeah, so political scientists talk that, so call that phenomenon Duverger's law, where in a constituency-based system, you're basically going to get two pretty big parties, which you pretty much see in the UK. You have the Lib Dems, but they don't, you know, they get a handful of seats. Even though they've got up to, you know, 20% of the vote in the past, they only, you know, don't really get much more than 10% of the vote.
And the US is another example of the same thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. But the proposals that we put forward, it would be a mix of the constituency and proportional representation system, where about 200 seats would be directly elected from constituencies, and then the other 200 would be top-up seats to ensure there's proportionality. And that is the system we use in our municipalities. So it's also the system that's used in Germany, it's a system that's used in New Zealand, a system that's used in Lesotho. It's called the mixed member proportional system. So in general, about half your seats are directly elected from constituencies, and then the other half from party lists to ensure proportionality. And that is what we've proposed. There've been other couple of proposals. Frederick van Zyl-Slabbert in the early part of this century, famously, there was a commission that he led about electoral reform. And it was pretty similar. They'd come up with, I think there was about 69 multi-member constituencies around the country, where they broke up South African 69 multi-member constituencies, electing between 3 and 7 representatives. They would have given you 300 representatives, and there would be 100 top-up seats to include proportionality. I think that's also quite a good system. But the system that that's been proposed now by the ANC is basically going to split South Africa into 9 multi-member constituencies by making each province a constituency. And it's a really bad system. It's going to be really hard for independents to get into parliament. It's not going to allow people to really run. They're still going to have to be backed by their parties and so on. It's a really bad system. And I think, it's not going to really solve the problems we've seen. And just on a final note, though, it's not that constituency systems don't, you know, magically create accountability. I do think there's an issue in our political culture, both from voters and from parties. But the current system isn't working. And there's an old saying that if it's not working, don't fix it. But I mean, if it's working, don't fix it. But this system is definitely not working. And I think we do need to tweak it. But we need to change our political culture, both from the people who cast the votes and from the people who actually get voted for.
I think one thing that we should just point out is that first past the post and constituency systems aren't the same thing. In Australia, they have a constituency system, but they have the first transferable vote system where you rank the parties in the order that you want. So constituency and first past the post is not one and the same thing. And I think first past the post does have some problems in it. But the real problem...
Yes. I must say, I really hate STB.
Oh, yes. But it's just important that distinction is that you can have a constituency system without necessarily having first past the post. And it is a false dichotomy, as Marius points out, that you don't have to choose between proportional representation and a constituency system. You can have a hybrid system. We already have that in South Africa on a local government level. The real challenge we need here is that the PR system, as Maya Mario says, does not work. And it does not work for a reason, because it isolates a lot of the political discourse. You can't just say PR in theory is better than a constituency-based system, because no system is perfect. Every system has its drawbacks. But if you look at the South African political context, this problem is accountability. That's why corruption and, you know, the crony capitalism that we see. That's how it happened. And to say that first past the post gave the Nats their victory in 1948, yes, well, I mean, proportional representation has given the ANC its victory for how long? And one of the things that proportional representation absolutely kills is the idea of a backbench MP. A backbench MP is actually a very, very important part of a parliamentary system where you have someone who stands as an ANC candidate, is elected to parliament, then sits in parliament, not thanks to the leader of the party, but actually because his voters, his or her voters, like the ANC party platform, but elected them to sit. In which case, if we look at the, for example, the 8 or 9 motions of no confidence against Zuma, those were just essentially box ticking exercises. If you have radical or rogue backbenchers, you can have weaker party discipline, and weaker party discipline tends to have better results in terms of deliberative democracy. And then moderate says here, accountability, how about starting with credibility? Well, I mean, why do you have to choose between the two? Why can't you have a constituency-based system boosting the credibility of democracy? I think, you know, such slogans is something that really irks me, or such, you know, sloganeering really irks me about South African citizenry, is that, you know, it's very, very easy to type that. But when it comes to actually making a difference and seeing how can we make this system work for South Africans, a statement like that gets us nowhere by putting these two things falsely against each other.
And I'd just like to answer Danny Archer's question there. Anyone know what the CODESA negotiations around electoral systems were? As far as I know, the ANC actually wanted a first-past-the-post constitution type system. They would have got, and in that kind of system, the ANC would have getting 70 to 85% of the seats in parliament. So I think that was actually one of those where they did back down on one of their demands and came up with that proportional representation system, which, I mean, which is all said and done, it does allow a lot of voices to get into parliament. And we've got 14 parties represented now. Some could argue there's too many or whatever the case is. But I think it was a way of getting lots of different voices represented in parliament, and different groups and stuff could feel like they were represented.
But one thing just to point out historically is that the PR system was very much seen as a stopgap system. The system that we are currently voting on was conceived of as a temporary system. That's why the Von Sell-Slobbert report was instituted, to rectify the system, because what many people don't know is that the first South African parliament of 1994-1999 was also the Constitutional Assembly, and the Constitutional Assembly got a lot of its legitimacy from being perfectly proportional from the people of South Africa in drawing up the constitution. From 1999 onwards, the expectation was that the system would change.
The only constitutional requirements for our electoral system is must be broadly proportional. That's the only thing the constitution says about the electoral system.
Yeah, which is a bit vague. I must say though that in the current political climate, though, I'm very nervous about electoral reform, precisely because, as you just say, Maurice, you know, the ANC is kind of throwing around ideas that are not very good right now. And when you have a party that's shrinking, it looks like it might lose the next election. The last thing you want is them changing the whole electoral system just before the election. because you can be sure that it's not going to be done in a nice and fair way.
Something I wanted to point out a bit earlier, one of the absurdities of the current, because there's currently the Electoral Amendment Bill before Parliament about, you know, there was a constitutional court judgment that says, you know,
the current system... To allow independence to stand.
Yes, the current system does not allow independent citizens to stand, and that's an infringement of the right of freedom of association. And the Constitutional Court gave instruction to Parliament to rectify this before I think the end of 2022 or something, but definitely before the next national election. And the system now currently, or the legislation currently introduced in Parliament, or recently introduced in Parliament, is to essentially treat independents and political parties the same. But the end of the end of that is that you sit in this bizarre position where someone, let's say an independent like, Frans Cronje, can stand for election and get 200,000 votes, and he gets one seat in parliament. Then someone like Herman Pretorius can stand for election and just eke above the necessary number of votes required for a seat. For France's 200,000 votes, and for my, 38,001 votes, we get the same result, a single seat. I think that is a very, very silly idea, and the reasoning of the Ministerial Advisory Committee is quite weak in that regard. So there is electoral reform coming, but it's quite a bad version of it.
Yeah, no, I don't think our system is... There's a contradiction there, I think, between having independence of the system and a PR system. But anyway, we shall have to see what actually comes out of Parliament before we critique this further. But anyway, we are out of time, so thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for watching. Please like the video, subscribe to our channel, spread the good word. We very much appreciate your support, and we will see you tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. I hope that you all have an excellent afternoon. Cheers.